our goal tonight is, this is actually the next part, is the sixth part in Making of a Monarch, and our focus this evening is going to be pretty high hopes, which is to get through Perek Ches, the entire chapter 8 of Sefer Shmuel Beis, and it is a very powerful and very interesting episode. Essentially, the overarching theme is all the conquests of David HaMelech. So David HaMelech makes many conquests in the neighboring countries around him, and this is a change of tune to anything we've heard up till now. Up till now, most of the time, it's always been us in retreat or us in defense. This sounds like it is the nation of Israel in offense, which is one of these infrequent moments in history where we hear about this. So let's go through the Pesukim, and actually the Perek is divided up into the different nations that he vanquishes, that David HaMelech vanquishes around him. So let's take a quick look in different sections. The first pasuk is the Philistines. The Philistines are the perennial enemy of the nation of Israel throughout the Bayis Rishon, throughout the first temple, towards the end of the time. And so this is the first vanquishing we have. We're told in the Pesukim, this is Perek Ches and Shmuel Beis, Vayhi acharei chen, and it was after this, Vayach David es haplishtim, Vayachniem, Vayichach David es mesek ha'ama miyad plishtim. And he humbles them, and he takes the meseg ha'ama. Ama literally means a cubit. So something, he takes something important from them, and he humbles them. Before moving on to the next nation, let's try to understand what exactly occurred over here. So first of all, before you're going any further, you'll notice something interesting, that there seems to be a connection between this perek and the last. What's the connection? What was that? Right, so immediately, the first thing we know is that the Pesukim themselves says it was after this that this occurred. Well, after the what have we just finished learning about? So let's recap for a second. We just finished with learning with how David HaMelech was denied the ability to make the Beis HaMikdash. After this, he now goes out and full conquest of the Philistines. Interesting, what do you think? What's the sequence of events here? How was the logical flow from one to the next? So the Malbim suggests a very fascinating thing. Let's take a look in source 50. This is in the packets of the Mefarshim. The Malbim says a very fascinating thing. Vayhi acharei chen, hoidioi Hashem al yedei navi ki loy hu yivneh habayis. After he finds out that he no longer can make the house, ba'asher od loy nichrusu oyevav mipanav, because the enemies was still prevalent in front of him, he realized, this was David HaMelech reading into the situation, that they couldn't make the Beis HaMikdash as long as there were enemies in their midst. So therefore, that means to say that what's incumbent upon me is to vanquish the enemies. Again, you see something fascinating about David HaMelech, that David HaMelech doesn't always wait for instructions. He intuits what Hashem must want. That's an incredible attribute. He intuits that Hashem wants a bayis, a house. And when Hashem says, well, not yet, then he intuits that Hashem wants clearing the playing field for the bayis. So it's just a very fascinating point to David HaMelech's way of operation. Yeah.
Does he not have nevuah?
It does seem like David HaMelech has nevuah, but even Nevi'im have moments where they're not getting nevuah, and they either exercise their intuition, their Ruach HaKodesh, various other, we'll call, lucid moments of deciding what's best. And that's what seems to be happening over here, which is just a very beautiful moment to appreciate that. So that's the movement from last parak to this parak, and that'll set the theme for everything we're about to encounter. So what's interesting is in humbling the Philistines, what does he do? He takes the Meseg HaAma, he takes this item. What is this item exactly from the Philistines? So there's numerous different explanations. I want to just present three of them for us to think about tonight. And these are good examples of how the Mefarshim will differ in general to understanding concepts in Tanakh. So the first, we're going to go deep down into Midrash. The first is actually, it's from the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer is one of the earliest Midrashim that we have extant. Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, he was the teacher of Rabbi Akiva. And his Midrash, his teachings are incorporated in Source 51. And the Chazal tell us that Kushimalach David, Ratzolav Alba Eres Plishtim, when David became a king, he wanted to enter the Philistine territory. Bris Yitzchak. And he was not able to because of the covenant of Yitzchak. Ad Shelokach Mehem Ois Bris Shvuas Yitzchak. Until they took the sign of the covenant of Isaac. So remember, If you go back to Parshas Toldos in the Torah, Yitzhak is a direct neighbor of the Philistines in Gerar. There's a whole scuffle around the wells, and they make a peace accord. That peace accord has some level of protection for the Philistines, and therefore, what they did was they took the symbol of that peace accord, wherever it was signed and sealed, the document, whether it be the actual item which represented it, they got rid of that. Once they got rid of that, then the peace accord falls, and they're able to do this. So David Melech went in and took away, essentially, ripped up their agreement. Fascinating way of looking at things. Okay, so that's one option. So it might be some sort of item which represents their peace, which David HaMelech is upsetting. But interestingly enough, what sometimes we need to do in these texts is not just read them in and of themselves and sort of work out what the words mean. Sometimes we can read them parallel to the other version of the story. Where's the other version of the story? In Dera Yamim, right? So if we read the parallel version of the story, it actually doesn't say that he captured Meseg Ha'amah. It actually says that he captured Gat. He captured the city Gat. Gat is one of the Philistine cities down south in the Gaza region. He captured Gat. So what does it mean? Was it Meseg Ha'amah or was it Gat? So he said, so the Radak in the Mitzuros in this particular place says, well, what it is that by capturing their crown city, by capturing the place where they had we'll call it the most dominant king, that was what caused the rest of them to fall in front of David HaMelech. So it wasn't an item of peace, it was really their crown jewel, which was their main city. Fascinating, different way of looking at things. How do we arrive at that conclusion? What the Mitzuros is doing, and like what other Mepharshim do, is they're looking at this grander context, which is including Dera Yamim. And finally, last thought on this page is, I should not include this, but there's another option over here. Let me just see if I can remember. Okay, no, I actually exclude that right now. But those are two options. Again, different ways of looking at things. Do you look at it midrashically? Do you look at it contextually? Very different ways of perspective over here. That's the first level. So the Philistines are humbled. By the way, it's only one pasuk, but it's this is like a watershed moment. I mean, they've had problems with the Philistines from time immemorial. All of Sefer Shmuel has been problems from Philistines. From Shimshon until Shaul, it's been terrible. The Philistines have been a real issue. It's, you know, the fact that David HaMelech quells that is pretty phenomenal. Okay, so now we move into the next. So now David HaMelech moves to the next step, which is to the Moabites. Now, I included a map. I think the printing came out pretty dark, I'm afraid, because of the toner. But if you take a look on the map over here, on the first page, on page 20 in the Mepharshim, there's a map of the Judea area and where all the different nations are. So on the bottom left, where the Gaza region is, and even further inwards, is the Philistia, right? That's where the Philistines were. Again, it should not be lost upon us that seems to always be a very difficult territory for Israel, right? Not that there's any cultural or blood connections necessarily, but there seems to always be a very difficult region. And on the right, in a darker area, just to the east, is Moab. Okay, so we're moving now into the area of Moab. So we're talking about we'll call it the Western Conquest. Now we're moving to the Eastern Conquest.
That's Jordan.
That's the lower regions of Jordan today. Exactly. So now, what happens over here? Interesting event occurs. So let's look at the Pesukim. The Pesukim is also very short, one Pasuk. Vayach es Moav, he conquers Moav. Vayimadadeim, bachevel hashkevo sam arzo, vayimadeid shnei chavalim lamis, umeloya chevel achios. What does he do? He lies everybody down on the ground, and he divides them into thirds. So how do you measure? You take out a rope. So three ropes of equal length. Two ropes worth of people are going to be killed. And one rope length are going to be spared. So one third of them are spared after this battle. And the remainder are now, we'll call it incense paying or gift bearing servants to David HaMelech. So just something to think about over here, and that is it doesn't sound like this is in battle. In battle, you don't line people up next to ropes. This is clearly after the battle, which raises some moral hairs on the back of our necks, which is like, you know, so how is this working? This is you killing non-combatants, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. Right? So David HaMelech is killing people not in the scope of battle. And, you know, today with, you know, We're very sensitive to these kind of things. So the first thing to bear in mind is Rabbi Norman Lamb gave a drasha about this a long while back, a number of decades back, about, you know, we'll call it anachronistic moral values. You know, when we think about war today, you know, today the sensitivity to war is unnecessary, war is cruel, war kills many people. But, you know, not too much more than a century ago, the war was glorious, war was noble, war was heroic. Yes, there were many deaths, but war was something to be looked up to. So we have to just remember that, you know, we have to be fair when we throw moral anachronistic principles backwards into history and judge from our perspective after two world wars and numerous genocides. So we have to think a little more, you know, in the terms of what the people were thinking at the time. Number one, but the Radak says there's also an additional layer of history here, and that is, take a look at this Radak, which is to be found in the sources. It is source 53. The Radak says a very interesting thing. V'omra bidrash. The drash says, so that's the deeper layer of meaning, says ki also ze bavur she misu aviv imoy va'achav kishenacha oisam be'eretz Moav kishe barach mipnei sha'ol. This was a vendetta, because David Melech actually left his mother and father and siblings in the hands of the Moabites when he was a refugee, because he realized that his family ultimately was a liability to him, because Shaul HaMelech would use them, torture them, or kill them in order to use them against David. So David HaMelech sent them into exile, and it turns out that the caretakers were not so good, and they murdered his parents and siblings. So David HaMelech had a debt to settle with the Moabites, and he settled it. He killed two-thirds of them, whether this means the officers, whether it means the privates, whether it means the civilians, we don't know. But nonetheless, David HaMelech took care, and there was revenge exacted for their treatment or their mistreatment of, well, perhaps the Geneva Conventions of the time, right, of their going against this. So this is just another level over here. We've seen before in Tanakh that people like Gideon in Sefer Shoftim take things very personally. Dorach does take things personally, but it doesn't go over the cliff like Gideon does, where Gideon takes everything personally. Dorach seems to manage to do what he needs to do, and he retracts. He doesn't get lost in personal spirals. Anyway, it's just very interesting to think about when trying to understand these things. You know, another example is the reason why Rav Lam is talking about this in his drasha is he's talking about the time where Shmuel HaNavi kills Agag, but Agag is not on the battlefield, so you're killing a non-combatant. So the question is how do we, you know, in our moral compass today, how do we understand that? And so Rabbi Lam was saying is we need to understand the scruples of the times and the morals of the times, that killing a soldier off the battlefield, certainly a king as well, maybe also preventing them from getting back on the battlefield. There's a different scope of logic or wartime law. At the time, so just to appreciate, you know, sometimes it's hard to come in with our sensitivities in 2019 to reverse back. Okay, anyways.
Relativism still exists today.
Excuse me?
Relativism still exists today. That's who's doing the fighting.
100%. 100%.
Yeah.
So that's nation number two. So the Philistines, he humbles them. He takes something from them, whether it be their city, whether it be their respect. He then goes and conquers Moab. He kills a whole lot of soldiers. They're now very much subdued to David, and now we move northwards. So he moves to Aram. So if you want to take a look on the maps, Aram is in the northern area. Let's see over here. It's this, in the area what's called the Syrian states. Okay, on the top right. This is where Syria is still today, miraculously. In the lower regions where Damascus is, so the southern regions of Syria, is where there's an area called Aram, Aram Damasek. Okay, and many of these areas are called Aram, and this is the Aram Damasek, which we're going to focus on here. So let's take a look back in the Pesukim for a moment. So our Pesukim are Gimel to Dalet. Vayach David es Hadad Ezer ben Rechov ben Melech Tzova ben Echto El Hashiv Yoda ben Har Pras. The first person he captures is the king of Tzova. Okay, Tzova is Aleppo. Okay, he captures... the king, whose name is Halad Ezer, who's the king of Aleppo. Vesrim elef ish ragli, vayaker David es kol rechev v'yoser mimenu mea rechev. So David conquers 1,700 chariots and 20,000 foot soldiers, and what he does is he vayaker, which literally means he hamstrings or makes them invalid. All the rechev, all the chariots. So obviously he does something to the horses that makes them unusable in war. Fascinating. So an interesting thing is, like, I don't know, when I visited Israel last, I took the kids to Latrun, and in Latrun there is, of course, a tank museum, right? And when you go to the tank museum, what's fascinating about Israel is that it's just, I mean, like, everywhere you walk is miracles. And you go through, and they have, of course, they have the Merkava Shesh, which is the Israeli constructed tank. It's an amazing state of the art system. But then they also have the older tanks that they were fighting in the good old wars, you know, in 67 and 73. And they have the requisitioned Syrian tanks and the requisitioned Egyptian tanks and all the tanks that they found. Meaning, when they fought the Egyptians, many of the Egyptians just fled. And what do? They simply took them back, added a few Israeli computer programs to them, repainted them olive green, and were really good to go, right? And so they were, and by the way, the Egyptian technology was superior to Israel. Israel was still dealing with World War II tanks and second-hand Czechoslovakian tanks, because those were the only people to sell them. And the French, God bless the French, who are a big ally, who stopped supplying us arms just before 1967. All these wonderful allies that we've always had. And so where did they get their tanks? They requisitioned the Egyptian tanks, and they added them to the columns and then carried on fighting. That's how it worked, right? So when you get come across a piece of military equipment, the first, what you would think is right now, so to just paint the Star of David, right? Talk about anachronism. Paint the Star of David on it and turn the chariots around and keep going, right? Why is David HaMelech destroying the horses? Why is he making them not fit for use? It doesn't seem like a very military sound strategy. So it's interesting. So there's a few options I've heard, and over the years I've heard different options. The first is that one of my teachers, Rabbi Chaim Angel, suggested that that right now the chariots are the superior technology. Which is, by the way, if you look at the map in general, you'll notice that that Israel is in control of the right side or the east side of Israel. What's the terrain in the east side of Israel? It's all mountains, okay? Up to towards where we get to the Kinneret area, but most of it is actually the hills of Judea. And the reason why that the Canaanites and the Philistines were not able to control those is because they had chariots. Chariots don't work so well in the mountains, right? So the Israelites were able to survive in the mountain territory, but when they came down to the coastal plains, they were actually had the lower hand in battle because of the chariots, which suggests that potentially the Israelites did not have the technology and perhaps didn't even know how to use the technology. So one possibility is the reason why they destroy it is because they just don't know how to do it. So they want to make sure that it's not going to fall into anybody else's hands, so they get rid of it. It's still a bit of a naive approach in the sense, if you think about it, because the way wars worked in those days, you tried to get somebody else's equipment, right? When you talk about the wooden chariot that the Egyptians invented and the Canaanites invented, the bronze chariot, which overtook, and that was the military, the QME, right, the qualitative military edge, which everybody talks about in those days, was what type of chariot you had. So how does it work? But moreover, if you go back to Sefer Yehoshua, in fact, it's interesting that is actually what actually happened then. One second, Yeah, so this is actually part of the commands then. So take a look at this. Let's see if I can find where I put this, what leave this out. Oh, dear. 54. Thank you. I'm in the wrong area here, yeah. Okay, so no, it's the machine isn't stapling either, so we have, if you know what I'm saying. So it's been one of those weeks. So in Sefer Yehoshua, Perek Yod Aleph, when they get instructions how to do conquest, they're told, "Vayamar Hashem al Yehoshua, al tira mibnehem, don't fear them." There's a coalition of five kings who is fighting against. So he says, "Tomorrow, Kaes Azoyes, Anochi Anosan is Kula Machalolim Ifnei Yisrael. They're all going to fall as corpses in front of you. Es Susayem Ta Akeres Makrovaseim Tisrof Baesh, hamstring their horses and burn their chariots." Interesting, right? And that's what he does, which is interesting because that means to say it isn't simply the people who don't know what to do. It seems to be God's will to be ma'akir, to hamstring these horses, right? Which suggests it isn't just circumstance. There's a plan here. So if there's a plan, then what's the plan? Why is Hashem so interested in this type of action? David HaMelech is clearly replicating what was done 350 years prior when conquering the land. So why is David HaMelech doing that? Obviously, David HaMelech has Sefer Yehoshua. It's extant at this point in time. Shmuel has written it down. Shmuel was David HaMelech's teacher, so David HaMelech has access to this, and we know that David HaMelech is the king of Israel, is aware of this. So he's clearly replicating this. Why was it in God's interest to hamstring the horses? So
the clarity that
okay, so one might be to okay, good. So to identify the miracle, right? So I mean, you say this is not because you know it's you know you walk back from battle and you have 1,700 chariots. You put the bumper sticker, we did it. Hashtag look at us. And that's really what it is. But yeah, maybe it's more of a humbling move. Barbara, what do you think?
Also, chariots require horses. Ready to die, then they have to go down to Egypt to get horses.
Okay, so interestingly enough, it could be related to one of the mitzvahs which a king is commanded to, and that is lo yarabe lo susim, that the king's not allowed to have too many horses. There's a debate in halacha between the Rambam and the Ramban. Does that mean to say personal horses, right, his personal stables? Or does that mean to say his military stables as well? How far does that extend? But it is interesting to think about from that perspective, that here we have the beginning of David HaMelech's monarchy, where David HaMelech is really sort of forming the foundation of what it looks like to be a king, and he's sensitive to the fact of not having too many horses. That's an interesting point. That's a very interesting point. And you get to see David HaMelech is not taking that moment to either return to Egypt, to show arrogance, by taking horses. Of course, horses still today are a status symbol and a symbol of power. Another option is, and I only discovered this recently, I happen to be learning personally, not for teaching. I'm learning the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which talks about Avodah Zarah. It's not one of those difficult just to realize. So one of the things it talks about all different types of polytheism, and there's halachas which apply to these different things. We need to know the parameters of what polytheism is in order to be able to understand the halachas which apply to it. So one of the interesting things they talk about is the following. Listen to this interesting scenario. The Gemara says in on Daf Yud Gimel and Aleph in 13a, the following case. Meisiv Rabbi Nosson, it brings a Tanatic source. Rabbi Nosson Omer, Yom Sha'avodas Kochavim, Maneches Boaz Lameches, Machrizim Vo'emrim. So let's say that the non-Jews have a festival, a polytheistic festival, right? So Saturnura, calendar, whatever the, all these wonderful, well, you know, their polytheistic festivals, and they say that today it's a tax-free day in honor of the festival. People don't have to pay tax, right? They make an announcement. All you need to do is wear a particular type of hat, put a particular type of, of hat on your donkey, and when you come to the stores, they will offer you a discount because it's a day of Avodah Zarah. And if you don't, you won't get the discount. So in this case, Yehudi shenimtza sham ma'yaseh. What should a Jew do in that situation? Yaniach nimtza nehene, putting the hat on, you're benefiting from Avodah Zarah, because of the festival, you are saving money. Lo yaniach nimtza mahane, but if you don't, then you are causing benefit, right? Because what's happening is your tax money is going to Avodah Zarah. So you're either benefiting or causing benefit to Avodah Zarah. Right, the tax, it wasn't because it was going to pay the street cleaners. Right, that's not how taxes worked in those days. Taxes went through the religious central government. Right, so which would go straight back into the coffers of what they were doing that day. So what do you do? So the Gemara says, Mikan Omru, Hanoise Venoise Meshuk Shalavarsko Chavim Behemot Yaker, Peros Susakarim de Irkavu, Maos Kleva Tchois Yolichem de Yamamelach. So that's why they said that anybody who conducts business in the idol worship marketplace, either to get benefit or to cause benefit, he needs to destroy any animal, he needs to throw out all the clothes or food that he bought there. Ve'ezo ikor, what is ikor? Hamanasher perososea min arkova ulamata. What does it mean, ikor? It means to say it cuts the hoofs from the knee and below. So we talk about it really seriously injuring the animal. And in fact, the Gemara goes on to say that ikor would be a process which would usually be a mortal or fatal condition, leave it for a little amount of time. So this is what Ikor is. But what do you see over here? Interesting thing. What is the context of this? The Gemara then goes on to say, let's just finish up this source. So yeah, the Gemara then says, Omar Mar Behemot Yaker Va'yikatzar Balechayim. So surely we don't actively cause pain to animals unnecessarily. So how could you do that? So Abaye Omar Abaye, one of the Amoraim living in the times of the Gemara, answered, Omar Achmona, the Torah itself says, or Nach itself says, Es Susehem Ta'aker, you shall destroy their horses. Who is that? Where is that pasuk from? Sefer Yoshua, when Hashem says it. Which means, what is the context of that pasuk that Gemara is telling us is, because it wasn't so much about military, it was about Avodah Zarah. Meaning to say that, apparently, we're supposed to understand that when they were fighting, it wasn't just simply that these horses were simply the vehicles of battle. These were also part of their deities. This was part, they lived as part of their pantheon. So destroying them was also uprooting Avodah Zarah in their land. Interesting. That doesn't mean to say that every nation that David HaMelech fights against has this problem. We don't see that he destroys the horses of every nation he fights. But it does seem that the folks in the north do have that problem. So not just being over here we'll call it a issue of arrogance or going down to Egypt, it might actually be a religious imperative from the fact of belief systems. Fascinating. Just a different way of looking at things.
It doesn't explain why they're maiming them and not killing
them. You're right.
It just doesn't feel good to
them. You're right. You're right. Spoken from a good dog owner. You're right. It seems that they still have some sort of function, that they can still have some sort of, we'll call it, domesticated function. In this, so as opposed to being used as respected either status symbols or military or carrying, so they'll be more domesticated kind of uses for a while. They're clearly like depleted and not their full strength. Okay, anyways, just fascinating idea. Let's move a little further. So that was Aram Tzova, which is in the north, that's Aleppo. Then we go a little further. So the next set of psukim we move into is now Damascus. So we're all in the northern area here. I'm just going to find the psukim myself. Here we go. It's psukim Hei to Ches. We're told, Batova Aram Damasek, he comes to Damascus. Vatavoi Aram Damasek, Lazor Lahadadezer Melech Tzova. So the neighbor, Damascus, sends troops to help those in Aleppo. And David HaMelech had a tremendous victory, killing 22,000 soldiers on that day. And David nisivim ba'aram demesek, v'tihilo aram leDavid la'avodim nosei mincha, v'yosha Hashem es David b'chol asher halach. David HaMelech then sends representatives who now are going to be permanent Israelite representatives in Damascus, who are now overseers of the tax payments going into Israel from Damascus as a vassal state. And Hashem saves David on this day. V'yikach David es shiltei hazahav, he brings these golden instruments back to Jerusalem. And he then goes and takes a tax from the surrounding cities of which are Betach and Berotai, which are the cities of Hadadezer, the king of Aleppo. Because obviously, in these days, the way it would work is there would be city states. Right, so there were like when we talk about the 31 kings of Canaan, that means that each city in this we'll call it in this the serfdom, like they'd have a surrounding area which in the fields and the villages around would be under one king. So he now goes and taxes the bronze out of the copper out of that area. It's interesting. What are these shlita shilte zahav? This is a debate in the Mefarshim. Rashi suggests that they are golden quivers. So it was a sign, a military sign that they would extract from the Aleppans. Is that how we say it? Aleppans had a rough last 10 years, unfortunately. Or it could be that they were actually golden shields. Either way, it seems to be a symbol of military strength and prowess. That they take them back to Jerusalem. One interesting historical footnote over here is that later on, David HaMelech establishes Jerusalem, and you can imagine, obviously the old city walls of Yerushalayim are not the ones that David HaMelech had. today. Those are later. Those are Ottoman and pieces of earlier wars, walls that we see around Jerusalem today. But imagine like sort of like looking at Jerusalem and these magnificent walls, and around the walls are golden shields. You know, it's just what a splendid entrance to Jerusalem. It is interesting that that lasted for a generation and a half. David HaMelech had them. In times of Shlomo HaMelech, he had them. But later on, when Shlomo HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech and the kingdom splits after in Rehoboam's times, his son signs, as we'll get to see, one of the first plunderings of Jerusalem is when the golden shields are taken. And I wonder if that's the same golden shields, if it's the Shilte HaZahav. But nonetheless, it's sort of the symbol of sovereignty is to be found in these golden shields. And there's an interesting thing that Rehoboam does is once he realizes that it was because of his actions that that was why this had occurred, he actually replaces them with bronze shields later on to remind himself of his sin. Every time he walks into Jerusalem, he would see that we'll call it tier 2 and remind himself that he was missing tier 1. But I think it may date back to this moment over here when they bring them back. Good. Now we're going to Hamas. Okay, so we move on into the next psukim. Tes to Yud Gimel. Vayishma to'i melech Hamas. So To'i here is about the conquest of Hadadezer. So one person goes, so Damascus goes to the aid of Aleppo. It sounds like Ta'i goes and tries to seek peace with David, seek homage with David by sending in gifts. So David donates all this gold and silver that he gets to Hashem. So he fills the coffers. Among all the other the treasures that he's got from all the surrounding nations. David and he makes himself a name when he comes back from the Gei HaMelech, the Valley of Salt, probably referring to the Dead Sea region, right? Where there was 18,000 people killed. That 18,000, the Mefarshim debate, because there seems to be discrepancies in numbers with Dirayim, seems to 12,000 there, and the Mefarshim says 12,000, 18,000. Okay, not for now to get into the specifics, but what do you think it means that he made for himself a name? How did David HaMelech make himself a name? It sounds like a positive thing. So he comes back from a battle and makes himself a name. Rashi says a phenomenal insight, something which makes us proud to be Jewish. Rashi says in 58, he buried the enemies. Right now, today, you know, there's certain conventions. In those days, leave them out for the vultures, right? So David HaMelech spent time. By the way, think about mass graves for 18,000 people. Those are big graves. That's a lot of man work, right? So David HaMelech buried the dead, which was a shame because the nations around the world recognized this in David HaMelech. Wow, that's an incredible sign of morality, which people recognized him for. I think to me this always makes me think about how far the Israeli army goes. You know, there was an article in the New York Times last week. And I know. It's not worth the time. But they had a article where they were able to work out. They spent hundreds of hours. They said, doing research that there was a medic. There was a young Palestinian girl who was killed. Terrible. And she was killed. And they spent hundreds of hours in analyzing many pictures and many reports and many first. And they worked out that it could have been that the bullet that hit the ground ricocheted and hit her. And he has the direction of the bullet, and he has the pictures and the whole thing. And therefore, there may have been negligence where that one bullet went into a crowd of protesters who were trying to get to the fence. You know, it was interesting enough that they forgot to mention that the drive-by shooting was actually aiming at the pregnant woman. Right, you know, that there wasn't. We didn't have to work out from pictures where he was aiming as he put the automatic on his gun, and he strafed the crowd of innocent bystanders. There wasn't an article explaining that they'd done the research to find out that the person actually wanted to kill all those civilians, right? But we need a lot of research. We need hundreds of hours to work out that there could have been negligence. That one bullet hit a medic. Why was there a medic next to the battlefield where the Israelis said, don't come. But anyways, but nonetheless, this what we have is you know, if you read the protocols of what it takes an Israeli to shoot when there's people coming towards the fence, I mean, it's shocking. Any other army in the world, like I remember when Ari Satcher came to our shul, you know, one of the questions was, are we selling the Iron Dome system to other countries? And he says, we're having trouble finding clients because we have no other peer country in the world that is being bombed in an urban area and is not getting rid of the enemy and just completely destroying anybody who's attacking them, right? So, like, we've never encountered any other problems like that, right? You simply carpet bomb the perpetrator, and there's silence. You don't have to worry about trying to make precisions which rocket's going to land in a children's playground or in a field, right? That's the Israeli army, is that we're dealing with a morally lopsided equation, and Vayas lo shame. David HaMelech had a shame. You know, he buried the dead. Nobody else was burying the dead in those times. Nobody else was trying to work out, you know, trying to work out equations and algorithms to be able to scientifically get the right person who is actually the threat and the terrorist among the crowds of 10,000 people. It's surgical precision. Nonetheless, Vayas lo shame. That's what we have. So some things don't change so much. Nonetheless, we move on to the next section, which is about Edom. So now Edom is actually, if you're going back to the map for a second, Edom is much harder to read, but it's directly below Moab. It's in the southeast corner. Okay, so that's where Edom is in Seir, and now David HaMelech's next conquest is here. We'll look at the Pesukim from it's going from Yud Dalad. It's just Yud Dalad by itself. Vayosem be Edom nitzivim, b'chol Edom sham nitzom nitzivim, vayish kol Edom avodim leDavid, vayosha Hashem es David b'chol asher holach. So he sends his overseers to Edom, and he has and wherever he goes, Hashem saves him. Why do we need to repeat that Hashem saves him wherever he goes? So it's interesting. The Malbim says that it could be that this is also referring to let's see over here. The Malbim says a very interesting thing. So this is referring to the future, not as only referring to David HaMelech at the time that we're talking in Perek Ches in Sefer Shmuel, but we're also talking about Vayosha Hashem as David, is that the Davidic Sion in the future is also going to have the success against Edom, Edom is the last Golas. So you'll notice this a lot. It's interesting. Later Mephoroshim, like the Abarbanel, the Malbim, will often do things like this, where they'll say that history has allowed us to see innuendos. Tanakh is not simply speaking to the immediate audience, but to the broader audience of Israel, and we ourselves are still waiting for our exit from this Golos under Edom. So that's another example of it. Yes.
I just want to know, who is he making David HaMelech? Who is he making a name to?
I guess the nations around. I guess it's a good question. I guess it's, I'm not sure. Rashi doesn't mention that. I imagine that the rest of the nation said, "Oh wow, look what a morally upstanding people." But it could also mean the Jews. It could mean the Jews themselves, the nation of Israel.
Because it's the same today.
Yes.
We're the only ones who are noticing.
You're right. You're absolutely right. You're right. Very, very legitimate points. Well, let's just see if there's any. I want to just see if we can just finish this section and then one or two questions on this. So let's just finish the perek. There's just really only four pesukim left. Test up to the end. David is called I'll call Israel. David is the king of all of Israel. By he David he did righteousness and justice to his whole people. And this is the cabinet of David, essentially. So we hear about all the different people in the positions. Yoav is the general. Yehoshaphat ben Achilud is the mazkir, the secretary. Tzadok and Achimelech ben Aviasar al Kohanim. Saraya is the sofer. And Benayahu is has the Urim v'Tumim. Okay, so, and the Bnei David al Kohanim, we have to see what that means. But nonetheless, so we get the sense of the cabinet of David. We'll see a number of times throughout Shmuel Beis and a little bit in Melachim as well, that will be told the cabinets, the various different, you know, leadership circles of David and Shlomo HaMelech. And it's important because these are transitionary points that the Tanakh needs to tell us to this. Question just to, yes?
Question. So
sure.
David now conquers all these things. Not one area in this do you see David thanking Hashem for saving. There's not one usually when...
You're right.
...an altar or something and you say whatever to Hashem. And he just conquered like all these lands and there's nothing.
You're right. So it's interesting. So I, you know, the fascinating thing about Sefer Shmuel is that a lot of the voice, the experience of David HaMelech, is actually left to another book. We call that Tehillim. So, like a lot of times when we look into Tehillim and we say, Hashem, you saved me from my enemies, we don't actually always know exactly which battle, but we could very Hashem Marabu Sarar Marabim Kamimala Rabim Orminim Nashian Yeshua Solabe Kim Sela. Right, so we say, oh, wait a second. That's when we say in Kriya Shema Lemitzah every night. That, oh, wait a second. Isn't that maybe that's actually referring to some of these things? So we're given the voice of it then. Also, at the end in Perikov Beis, in the very end, we're going to hear the Shira of David, Shira of David HaMelech, which is actually matching to a certain Tehillim. And even if he may not be saying it now, some people say, why did he wait until the end of his life to sort of publish that Shira? Either he sort of experienced it and at individual points, and he coalesced it into one song at the end of his life. Or no, he waited till the end of his life because he knew that we hadn't yet got to the peak of this mountain. But we have to think about this. It's worthwhile thinking about the perspective, because we're not hearing about his perspective, we're just hearing about the history here. Yeah.
It's also possible that he did, and it's just not recorded.
Yes,
yeah,
yes,
right. What I'm saying is, I'm sorry, it's not recorded, because usually they do record those things always.
You're right.
Say, like battle after battle.
Yeah, this seems to be just like a historical survey. Right, this is a historical survey, this is what happened. And now, and by the way, it's very contracted. It's not, we don't have very many details. We have a few interesting details which we focused on as we went through this. But in general, it seems to be like getting through to the next point, because we're going to reach the meat of the drama soon, right? We're going to get David HaMelech's real life challenges in just a few moments. But yeah, it seems to be like just sort of fair picture. And we should also, you know, feel very good about ourselves. It's like, this is Israel expanding. When does Israel expand? It's always been under siege. This is an incredible moment. One question that perhaps we'll end with this, and that is, are these conquests legitimate? So you say, of course they're legitimate. David HaMelech is the king. He's the king of Israel. Hashem is just appointed him. This is what he did. So interestingly enough, there is a discussion in Halacha about trumos and maestros. Truma is when you grow fruit in the land of Israel, you have to give a tithe of it to the Kohen. So you go to Machane Yehuda, and you have let's say you buy a bag of grapes, and you have not, and they don't have a hashgacha, so they're not under a reliable hashgacha. You can't just eat those grapes. You have to give truma, right? So there's a section in the Siddur how you designate this one goes to truma, this one goes to maaser to allow the rest of them to be eaten, right? Just right. Halacha is a truma. It's an amazing opportunity which we don't have. Yeah, it's much more complicated to eat in Israel than it is here. But now here's the interesting thing: is where is Israel? So, like, how far do you go? So, there's different boundaries of Israel. In the halachas of the boundaries of Israel, regarding the halachas of Trumos, the Rambam says the following. The Rambam Mishnah Torah in the next source says the following. And this is translated. Haratzah shekavash David chutz le'eretz Canaan, the lands which David made a conquer outside the land of Canaan, kagon, Aram Naharaim, Aram Tzava, va'achla va'kayetz bohem, so Aleppo, the areas in the Syrian area, afal bishamelach Yisrael hu, I'll be based in Agorol hu, I say, even though he did it, he is a king, and he did it with the consent of Beis Din, Einok Eretz Yisrael l'chol davar. It's not exactly like Israel in every halachic sense, right? V'lo kechutzal aretz l'chol davar. It's not like the diaspora in every sense. Kegon be'abavel Mitzrayim, like Babylon, like north of the Euphrates and south of the Nile, is a diaspora. Ela yotzu michlal chutzal aretz liyosam keeretz Yisrael lo igio mipnei ma yordu mimalas eretz Yisrael. Why they're not like Israel? He didn't fully conquer the Canaanites before he went and expanded the territory northwards and southwards. So if he had fully vanquished the seven nations, the Canaanites who are on the northwest coast first, then conquer the rest, they would have more of a legitimate standing. But it doesn't have the full status of Israel for halachic purposes. That's something we should bear in mind. So did David HaMelech do it with permission? Absolutely. Did it count as this? Not necessarily. Last thing, and just we're not going to read this inside, but if you're interested, this is a really remarkable source. And that is that the Midrash describes, this is the Midrash in Bereshis Rabbah, which can be found let's see where it is. It is the sources of in source 61, it's in Ayin Dalet, Tezvav. The Midrash says that when David HaMelech came up to conquer the Edomites, they said, wait a second, there's a passage in the Torah which says you can't conquer the Edomites. And then he came to the Moabites, and they pulled out their pasuk. They had, like, the Midrash used the word epistle. They had epistuli. Right, they had a letter saying the Torah says you can't conquer us. You can't conquer the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites. And Dawud didn't know what to do. So he went. The Midrash describes as he went back to Jerusalem, he took off his war gear, donned his humble clothes, went into Beis Din and said, "What do we do?" And the Beis Din in each account said, "Did they start with you? Did you start? How did the war start? If they attack you, you can." And Dawud proved in each instance that started the war and was able, therefore, to go to war. Fascinating. Not so simple. Another aspect of this we don't really know is was Dawud HaMelech licensed to do this? Answer is he was. But nonetheless, the interesting thing about this is that the expanded, we'll call it Israel expanded, right, to the where Jordan is today, to where Syria is today, those areas which Dawud HaMelech controlled, this is all Israel, all tax-paying Israel, didn't last so long. It was actually these territories which were the first ones, obviously, to fall when the kingdom started crumbling and splitting. And we see that they didn't have longevity. But we do know that the Torah says that ultimately, when Israel will reach its full boundaries, this will be. This is not Merica Hina speaking. This is the right two banks of the Jordan. The Torah itself says that the Torah will promise the lands of the Kadmoni, Knizi, there's a third one with the Kuf, which is in the north area, which is going to be promised to us. Not just the seven nations, but the 10 nations of the land of Israel. And this is something ultimately which will be at a particular time. It seems interesting that Dawud HaMelech was not able to do it fully 100% correctly. He should have potentially, as the Rambam says, conquered the locals first and then have got there. But from this point onwards, never in history did we have that, except for 1967 and 73, where we reached Damascus in both cases, and the UN got frightened at that point in time and called an immediate ceasefire, not when we were being attacked. So until those times, we've not really seen this kind of expansion. Yes, Leah.
So what areas now in Israel are, like, you wouldn't have to do Truma Shvita, like in Eilat, you don't have to do...
So in Eilat would be an example, and interestingly enough, there's a discussion about the Golan Heights, because
right.
If you look carefully over here, not to accede to the maps that say Syrian Israeli occupied Syrian territory. It's not because of that. That's not the reason. The reason is because way back when, 3,000 years ago, when Dawud HaMelech conquered it, it was a separate halachic entity, and that's the reason. Yeah, Alicia.
Well, why didn't he conquer the Khanate first?
Not sure. We really don't know. It's a curious. It might have been they were stronger. It could have been they had more peace accords. We don't know. Anyways.